With the latest in agriculture news from across the state and the country, it's Farm City News Day. And here's your host, Sabrina Hill.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us this morning for your agriculture news. Today is Tuesday, August the 1st. Coming up in today's show, could tariffs from Japan have been avoided with TPP? And an interview I'm very excited about, a well-known scientist and ag advocate, talks about bad science and how it's used against agriculture. We'll be talking with Kevin Folta later on in the show. We're starting off this morning with Brian German.
The California Farm Bureau Federation is conducting a survey to get a better understanding of the labor availability in agriculture and its impact on family farmers and ranchers in California. The CFBF is encouraging as much participation as possible in the survey, which will remain available until Wednesday, August 9th. Ryan Jacobson, executive director of the Fresno County Farm Bureau, explained the benefits of gathering this kind of information in creating viable resolutions in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country.
They've asked agriculturalists up and down the state to participate in a survey that's available on their website, cfbf.com, and they're able to go on there, take the survey, and just kind of report what they're seeing from their specific operation. And obviously, the more information we collect, the more information we're able to aggregate. And that becomes very, very helpful when we start talking to our senators, to our congressional representatives, as far as obviously this is a situation that's been up and down over the years, but it's a constant situation in the agriculture industry.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West.
The U.S. Grains Council summer meeting is getting underway this week in Vancouver, Washington. Starting today and lasting through August 2nd, the meeting includes the USGC's 57th Annual Board of Delegates meeting. More than 300 Grains Council members, delegates, and guests are taking part in the meeting. The meeting schedule will offer deep dives into emerging ethanol opportunities, China's growing influence in global trade, and the U.S. approach to trade policy negotiations, including the coming modernization of the North American Free Trade Agreement. Advisory teams for the Grains Council are also meeting to track progress toward the implementation of the 2017 Unified Export Strategy. New pork processing capacity is being added in the United States, but slaughter capacity will remain tight. Steve Meyer, who is with EMI Analytics, says the industry was at or above capacity a year ago. That will likely happen again in the fourth quarter of this year.
We hear that the plant in Sioux City is going to be probably delayed from its announced September 5th opening. Coldwater says that they're going to open that plant on September 5th, and it sounds like they're kind of committed to that. So, but still, even with a normal ramp up, those plants aren't going to be full by the end of the year, and we're going to have plenty of hogs. I mean, we've got fourth quarter slaughter up 3.2% from a year ago, and that was record large. So we think that capacity is going to be very tight again this fall.
There will be more competition for hogs, which will be reasonably good. Meyer expects prices to be in the 60s.
The good thing is that's still covering costs for the best producer and probably getting pretty close for the average producer out there. So we don't see a lot of red ink, even though the capacity thing could be tight this fall.
For more information, producers can contact the Pork Checkoff Service Center. USDA and FFA are pledging to work together on more projects and programs to support America's next generation of farmers and leaders in all aspects of agriculture. Gary Crawford reports.
Here on the indoor patio of USDA headquarters building in Washington Wednesday,
I want to mobilize the young people, both FFA and our Youth of American Agriculture, to tell the great story of American agriculture.
Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue addressing hundreds of FFA leaders from around the country. They were here to celebrate the signing of a Memorandum of Understanding between the USDA and the National FFA Organization, an agreement to collaborate on all kinds of youth-oriented projects. FFA's CEO, Mark Peschel, told us.
I think tangibly it means that students will have opportunities to understand more about the 250-plus careers that are unique to agriculture and how it impacts the future.
And Secretary Perdue said the future of agriculture starts now with these young people.
We need the vitality of these youth to come in to make sure that we can be as productive in the next 50 years as we've been in the last 50 years.
In Washington, Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Japan's just announced safeguard tariff on frozen U.S. beef could have been prevented with the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement the U.S. pulled out of, or a bilateral deal. The U.S. beef industry says, had TPP been in effect, or had the U.S. had a bilateral trade deal with Japan like Australia, Tokyo's automatic 50% safeguard tariff from August 1st through next March 31st could have been avoided. First quarter U.S. sales triggered the tariff. U.S. Meat Export Federation Chief Phil Singh.
safeguard that they had in TPP was on a yearly basis, and it was much more liberal. So I have the feeling because we just exceeded the amount by only 113 metric tons, it was very, very close under this old administration, but definitely under TPP, but this would not have been the case.
Singh says Japan's WTO-permitted 11.5% tariff hike could have a big impact on frozen beef sales in the U.S.'s largest beef market, worth $1.5 billion, close to half of that frozen.
This is going to impact the food service market, especially in Japan. They have certain items in their cuisine, which they call the beef bowl, where they have beef on top of rice. This is primarily our frozen short plates. That's 90% of our frozen inventory. And so that's going to have an impact pretty much immediately. There's some inventory in Japan, but as this goes on, if it goes on for, let's say, a month or two, there's going to be more pronounced impact.
And Australian frozen beef suddenly has a nearly 23% tariff advantage over U.S. beef, while Mexico won a similar deal. USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue says Japan's higher tariff will impede U.S. beef sales, increase the overall U.S. trade deficit with Japan, hurt Japanese consumers, and harm the trade relationship. Perdue has asked Japanese officials to address the concerns, though Sang says decisions to suspend the automatic tariff would have to come from Japan's legislature. This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I'm your host, Sabrina Hill. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Attention, California citrus growers, production managers, industry professionals. The 26th annual Citrus Expo in Fort Myers, Florida is proud to host U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue on August 16th, the first day of the show. Make plans now to attend the 26th annual Citrus Expo on August 16th and 17th for an opportunity to mingle with Secretary Perdue on the trade show floor. The latest in citrus research and data will also be presented at over a dozen seminars. Don't wait. Pre-register now at citrusexpo.net.
Your local DuPont Pioneer team doesn't take with you from the word go lightly, especially when it comes to forages. Just ask your fellow producers, folks like Amos Smith.
We have an awesome support team from Pioneer. I think that they're probably one of the reasons why we are successful.
And Bruce Cullum.
They'll come out just anytime you want to call them and help us. You don't get that from all your other seed dealers, but these guys are here all season long.
As well as Ken Felt.
Just know that, you know, the research that Pioneer's done, it really, it shows, and that the cows really do well with it, so we continue to use it.
Or Billy Rucker.
All in all, you know, seem like Pioneer is always in the top. I bleed green, and I bleed Pioneer.
Want a team that's with you from the word go? That's DuPont Pioneer. Ask them about leveraging the silage zone resource to produce the highest quality forages for your operation. Pioneer, with you from the word go.
What's happening below the surface can mean success or failure for your crops. New MycoApply Endomax from Valent USA Corporation is the latest innovation to help take your tree nut, tree fruit, vine, and vegetable crops to the next level. MycoApply Endomax contains a unique blend of four mycorrhizal fungi that colonizes a plant's roots to create a symbiotic root and mycelial network. Where water is limited, this enhanced network improves plant vigor by expanding the root's ability to efficiently absorb water and nutrients under variable environmental conditions. Ultimately, MycoApply Endomax helps deliver consistent plant health and overall performance to optimize yield. Plus, MycoApply Endomax is OMRI-listed for organic production. Maximize your crop's potential with new MycoApply Endomax from Valent. For more information, contact your PCA or visit valent.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's Taylor Hillman.
AgNet West told you last week about a residential grapefruit tree in Riverside that tested positive for Huanglongbing disease. The tree has since been removed, and both an 800-meter Asian citricilla treatment perimeter and a 5-mile radius quarantine will be put around the area of the find. As previously reported, that quarantine will impact some of the industry, locking down movement from a couple nurseries and part of UC Riverside, among others.
As of today, everything is put on hold within that quarantine, and that's at all nurseries, farmers markets, any host material from, you know, from residential areas, and also, of course, at the university as well.
Riverside County Ag Commissioner Ruben Arroyo said UC Riverside had been planning for this possibility and has some measures in place that may allow them to continue to operate with little changes.
Now, I know the university had been in preparation, of a potential HLB quarantine, had been started that process on some of their properties there. So we'll be working with CDFA and USDA, of course, on continuing that effort and working with them so that they can continue to move plant material outside of the quarantine.
I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
The program to eradicate Asian long-horned beetles involves removing infested trees to make sure the beetles are completely gone. Stephanie Ho has more.
USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, or APHIS, is in the midst of an eradication program to wipe out a destructive and invasive pest known as the Asian longhorned beetle.
The eradication program for Asian longhorned beetle is an effort by USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service to eliminate Asian longhorned beetle.
That was APHIS Public Information Officer Rhonda Santos.
The beetle actually attacks a lot of our hardwood trees, and the damage that it causes weakens the tree, and so they can become safety hazards for folks and property.
Asian longhorned beetle quarantine areas are in Massachusetts, New York, and Ohio.
We have employees that go out and actually inspect trees, so they look at the trees that this beetle attacks, and they look for signs of damage, such as the exit holes, egg sites, and even the beetle itself.
Asian longhorned beetles are shiny black insects about 1.5 inches long with speckled white spots. This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Well, in today's livestock news, dairy industry members and supporters are looking at ways to improve and build upon the Margin Protection Program, or MPP, as a risk management tool. Rod Bain has the story.
The 2014 Farm Bill ushered a change in the dairy safety net with the Margin Protection Program. As Jim Mulhern of the National Milk Producers Federation explains,
for a long time, dairy policy in the United States was more focused on a price support level where the government came into the market to buy stocks when we were in surplus to take that product off the market, stabilize price, sell it back into the market when prices began to improve. The Margin Protection Program put into the 2014 Farm Bill was really an introduction of risk management for dairy.
And while many in the dairy industry and industry supporters agree that MPP is the future in the farm safety net, in the present, there needs to be some fine-tuning. Mulhern's colleague at the National Milk Producers Federation, Chris Galen, says, for instance, assumptions such as the premiums and formulas for how milk and feed prices are both calculated are written into the law.
The way that the corn price, the soybean meal price, and the hay price are calculated actually underestimates the cost of buying those things. So it actually overstates how good margins are when feed prices are low. Farmers have worse margins now than what the official USDA calculation is, because when you assign a value to corn, soybean meal, and hay, those are kind of arbitrary. Those were changed by Congress kind of at the last minute when the Farm Bill was created.
A second issue, according to Jim Mulhern, is the price of buying supplemental insurance.
In order to have an effective program, farmers must be able to afford the coverage. And adjusting those premium rates, especially the rates at the lower levels of milk production, will help ensure that MPP provides the safety net coverage that we need for our industry.
And while proposed changes to the Margin Protection Program would mostly occur within the framework of a new farm bill, Chris Galen says some administrative adjustments could be made by the Agriculture Department to improve the program for dairy producers. In fact,
one of the things that Secretary Perdue talked about during his confirmation hearing is, are there other ways that we can construct the MPP to complement the Livestock Gross Margin Program and make that more of a complementary tool with MPP?
However, dairy producers currently are only allowed to choose either MPP or LGM coverage, not both.
Our view is that these programs actually can work in a complementary fashion. There may be some other ways you can adjust them so that the LGM can work together in tandem with MPP.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. And a successful stockmanship and stewardship program from the National Cattlemen's Beef Association took place back in June at the University of California, Davis. But the next regional event in the state is set to be held September 29th and 30th in San Luis Obispo. The two-day event for cattlemen and women will provide cattle handling suggestions and education that'll help improve your bottom lines. These sessions include a variety of educational opportunities for cattle producers. For more information, simply go to stockmanshipandstewardship.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
There were a few problems, but overall, the 2017 watermelon crop was a good one. You know, we grow a lot of watermelons in this country, but China grows a lot more than we do. Here's some other facts I didn't know. Watermelons were first grown in Africa. Worldwide, there are some 1,200 varieties. Here in the U.S., Florida, California, Texas, Georgia, and Arizona are the five largest growers, and in that order. There are two genetic factors that may surprise you. The watermelon is a vegetable. In fact, it's a member of the gourd family. It's 92% water and the most consumed vegetable on the planet. History doesn't tell us when the watermelons were first grown, but they've been harvested for over 5,000 years. Personally, I like mine ice cold with a little sprinkle of salt. And that's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, Agnet West.
In today's interview segment, I am talking with Kevin Folta on bad science and how it can be used against agriculture. Folta is a land-grant scientist and professor and chairman of the Horticulture Sciences Department at the University of Florida. Here's our interview. First off, I want to thank you for taking a few minutes out of your schedule. I know that you are very busy, so thank you for this. We talked a little bit on Twitter. I agree it's a very important story. What I would like to do is to start off with, this all comes from a story that was published about Ben and Jerry's ice cream and about trace amounts of a certain pesticide that was used or that was found in the ice cream, allegedly by a study. Now, you really went into depth about this and about why there's a lot of information out there that just cannot be trusted. Can you give our listeners some base knowledge about this?
Well, we live in an age right now where consumers are really asking questions about their food, and they're very concerned because of information they're learning from the internet. And what's happened is you're now seeing the information used in a negative way. In other words, if you can get a story out there that says our competitor or a company we don't like has some kind of something in their product, it can be very damaging, and I think it's being used for political reasons.
And there are a lot of ways to determine whether this information is correct or if it's something that is being used as propaganda. What are some things that people can look for to know if their information that they're reading is actually legitimate?
Well, if something appears in the New York Times or somewhere on the internet, the writer should have referred to an actual scientific study that's been vetted through the peer review. What it means is that a scientist performs a series of techniques and measurements and then submits those to a journal where they're published and reviewed by, or before they're published, are reviewed by editors and blind reviewers that can give an honest critique of the methods and the appropriateness of the interpretations. This didn't happen with this particular report. An activist group funded an activist lab to find a chemical. They claim to have found it in very, very, very small amounts, and then it's published directly on the front page of the New York Times. I mean, that's not the way that we publish science.
The peer review process is very important in scientific studies. Can you go into just a little bit more about how that works?
Well, peer review is extremely important. What it means is that as a scientist, I would prepare a manuscript about the data I'm presenting, which then goes to a journal where an editor picks maybe a few folks who know me, maybe a few folks who really disagree with the way that I interpret data, or maybe people who are curious about the work that we're doing. In this case, two, three, four, sometimes more reviewers provide an anonymous and very critical review. Even your friends will provide a very critical review because they don't want you publishing something wrong. This whole process takes months. It's a very rigorous process, at which point we get the reviews back, we revise the work, goes back, and then again, everybody looks at it and says, okay, we like the changes. It's an extremely rigorous process, which is the foundation of science. And so the peer review process plus independent replication are extremely important. None of that happened with respect to the glyphosate in Ben and Jerry's work.
Now, you're not just out backing up Ben and Jerry's. You actually have a very strong science base, and that's where your knowledge comes from, correct?
That's right. If anything, I'm not really thrilled with Ben and Jerry's. They've held some opinions and have actually put a lot of money into campaigns to fight for labeling of products in ways that weren't necessarily scientific. They've stood up against genetic engineering, which is a very important technology for many of our farmers. I'm no friend of Ben and Jerry's. I don't know that I've ever eaten it. But I do have to stand up for science here, that people are using science in malicious ways to tarnish the reputation of a company they don't like.
And it's not just this case, and you've pointed it out earlier, but let's go back to that. This is actually a technique that is used often in anti-agriculture propaganda, again, is to use junk science or sometimes things that are just simply made up to attack agricultural methods. Is that something that you've seen?
100%. This is about activists who can't discuss the science and don't have evidence on their side, using contrived bogus stories or even false information, false made-up data in many cases, to erode the trust in agriculture, to erode the trust in the media, to erode the trust in scientists. I've been personally a victim of attacks by the same organization that funded the attacks on Ben and Jerry's. Ben and Jerry's is a multi-million dollar corporation. They're not two hippies churning milk in a freezer. I mean, this is a big company that the activists don't like where they source their milk. And so this has been going on for ages. Now this is a way to make them pay because they didn't do it the way the activists demanded.
Once again, talking with Kevin Folta of the University of Florida. The interview will continue right after this. This is Farm City Newsday. I'm Sabrina Hill, and we will be back in just a moment.
Attention, California citrus growers, production managers, industry professionals. The 26th annual Citrus Expo in Fort Myers, Florida is proud to host U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Sunny Perdue on August 16th, the first day of the show. Make plans now to attend the 26th annual Citrus Expo on August 16th and 17th for an opportunity to mingle with Secretary Perdue on the trade show floor. The latest in citrus research and data will also be presented at over a dozen seminars. Don't wait. Pre-register now at citrusexpo.net.
Your local DuPont Pioneer team doesn't take with you from the word go lightly, especially when it comes to forages. Just ask your fellow producers, folks like Amos Smith.
We have an awesome support team from Pioneer. I think that they're probably one of the reasons why we are successful.
And Bruce Cullum.
They'll come out just anytime you want to call them and help us. You don't get that from all your other seed dealers. But these guys are here all season long.
As well as Ken Felt.
Just know that, you know, the research that Pioneer's done, it really, it shows, and that the cows really do well with it, so we continue to use it.
Or Billy Rucker.
All in all, you know, seem like Pioneer is always in the top. I bleed green, and I bleed Pioneer.
Want a team that's with you from the word go? That's DuPont Pioneer. Ask them about leveraging the silage zone resource to produce the highest quality forages for your operation. Pioneer, with you from the word go.
This is Farm City Newsday. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. We'll be right back with more of the news that's important to you.
What's happening below the surface can mean success or failure for your crops. New MycoApply Endomax from Valent USA Corporation is the latest innovation to help take your tree nut, tree fruit, vine, and vegetable crops to the next level. MycoApply Endomax contains a unique blend of four mycorrhizal fungi that colonizes a plant's roots to create a symbiotic root and mycelial network. Where water is limited, this enhanced network improves plant vigor by expanding the root's ability to efficiently absorb water and nutrients under variable environmental conditions. Ultimately, MycoApply Endomax helps deliver consistent plant health and overall performance to optimize yield. Plus, MycoApply Endomax is OMRI-listed for organic production. Maximize your crop's potential with new MycoApply Endomax from Valent. For more information, contact your PCA or visit valent.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We continue now talking with Kevin Folta of the University of Florida. There's just so many questions. I'm not even sure we can get into them all. But, you know, what happens if the public starts folding to these activists, and if we start seeing more people believe the stuff that's published.
But people do fold, because people say, if this is a shadow of a doubt that there's something here that could hurt my family, I'm not going to buy those products. And I understand that sentiment, because it is scary to talk about, you know, chemicals or, like they say, pesticides in our food. But this is an herbicide that is extremely safe and extremely environmentally friendly. It's something that we shouldn't be fearing, because it helps our agricultural producers produce more with fewer inputs and less toxicity. This is a really good thing. The problem is the activists don't like the companies that make the seeds that go along with these corresponding herbicides. And the way to stop it is to stop farmers from using it by stopping the demand, and also claiming that this product is showing up in the food. It may or may not have been, and even if it was, it's there at these levels that are so low, like 1 second in a billion years. Or no, 1 second in 32 years. That's one part per billion, 1 second in 32 years. Those are the levels that they claim are there, and they are millions of times below what is biologically relevant to health.
I don't remember exactly the number that I read, but it was something like you would have to eat 100,000 servings of ice cream for this to even have effect on you.
Yeah, 45,000 pints of of ice cream, which at which at some point you're probably going to have some blood sugar issues before you ever hit the tolerance for the herbicide.
Yeah, and all my listeners know I love my ice cream, but I'm not even going to come close to that. So if the study were accurate, which we're not even sure that it is, because as you pointed out, there were so many problems with this study, starting with the point that they were on a mission to prove something. And when you're on a mission to prove something like that, you're going to, whether you have to bend facts or whatever. But there's so many problems with this study. But even if there wasn't, their results were so minimal. I can't even see how it's an issue.
But that's the point, is that it keys off of this idea of shadow of a doubt, right? Mm-hmm. They say, oh, there's almost none there. You'd have to eat 45,000 pints. But then they say, but we really don't know, do we? And maybe it's a problem. And the IARC is maybe thinking that this is a carcinogen. The problem is that that's the New York Times, very credible source historically. Then what happens is that the second tier of websites of non-critical news of other sources pick this up and now say, carcinogen found in ice cream, don't eat it. And so it's about bending the story in the game of telephone that activists are hoping will be played, that as the story grows and morphs and changes, that it'll turn people away from the target, who is Ben and Jerry's.
And you write some very good information on topics such as this. Can we plug your spot where you're published on the website so our listeners can check that out?
Oh, sure. I mean, things are everywhere on the web. I mostly do it on a blog called Illumination. I write quite a bit for Medium, and also do a podcast called Talking Biotech. And tomorrow, the Talking Biotech podcast will feature the dissection of the story of Ben and Jerry's and glyphosate. A discussion with a couple different scientists, including one who works on detection of glyphosate in milk. So it'll be more detailed conversation on this topic.
For our listeners, now most of our listeners are ag-related or, you know, farmers and in the ag industry, but it's radio, so we have listeners who are not. For our listeners who are not, who maybe don't understand this or who do understand and want to have this conversation with their friends who are believing these stories that are out there, can you give them some advice or help them along with that conversation?
Oh, certainly. Well, the best advice is to consider that this source was not a scientific study or a scientific report. It was something commissioned by activists, by an activist lab, to find something that may or may not be there. So right away, the motivations are very clear that this is about finding a problem with the product. It targets a product that the activists have been wanting to change and wanting to change the production practices of that company for some time. So there's a lot of motivation here. And then the last thing that to keep in mind is that if the levels reported were real, the levels far below, millions of times below, what would be considered biologically relevant or potentially risky? And this is a really safe chemical to begin with in terms of its very low toxicity profile. And trace amounts of it showing up, it's a chemical that goes right through you. and doesn't have a lot of doesn't have any biological relevance at the levels reported.
Those are all the questions that I had for you, but is there anything that we're missing or any other point that you would like to make for our listeners, Kevin?
Well, I think the most important point is to keep in mind who is starting this entire process. There are organizations inside Vermont that are not excited about dairy, they're not excited about agriculture. They want things done their way or the highway. And then on top of it, they're tied up with an organization called Organic Consumers Association, who are really a political activist organization. They are not necessarily looking out for organic farming and organic farmers, yet they borrow their halo and do some pretty bad stuff. They've really maligned a number of researchers. They financed the freedom of information-based attacks on researchers, such as the ones I've endured, have cost my university probably $500,000 to the taxpayer to address the demands of this organization. It's really unfair what they do in the name of doing the right thing. They're actually doing something very bad, and it hurts agriculture, and it hurts the scientists associated with agriculture.
I want to thank you again. I know that your schedule is really tough to fit another interview in, so I appreciate it. Thank you, Kevin.
Oh, you know, anytime, just let me know. I love the media and love to help help with any issue I can assist with, anytime.
Thank you again, Kevin Folta, University of Florida professor and chairman of the Horticulture Sciences Department. For more on any of the stories you've heard here this morning, visit our website at agnetwest.com. You can also find us on Twitter at agnetwest or myself at Sabrina W. Hill. This has been Farm City News Day by Agnet West, and I am your host, Sabrina Hill. Have a wonderful day.